action. Many of the old familiar notes were struck by the old familiar people, but the meeting also offered bolder fare. Leighton Ford, who had begun to appear on the Hour of Decision broadcast almost as often as Graham, and was unofficially being groomed to succeed him, declared it a shame the church had been so slow to face the demands of the gospel in the racial revolution of our time. And Stephen Olford warned of what could happen when church people clung to segregation. When he arrived at New York's Calvary Baptist Church, he reported he found it staunchly segregationist. After he preached and taught a series of lessons on the evils of such an arrangement, all but 11 members voted to integrate the church. Of those 11, 4 soon confessed their sin and repented. Of the stony-hearted remainder, all 7 died shortly thereafter. In the dramatic, riveting manner that had arrested a young Billy Graham's attention more than 20 years earlier, Olford thundered the explanation of their deaths. God's judgment fell. Black delegates to the Congress moved well beyond their white brethren. Tom Skinner, a former Harlem gang leader who admitted stabbing at least 22 people before being converted by a gospel radio broadcast, acknowledged that Mr. Graham has been an outstanding spokesman in terms of the gospel of Jesus Christ in healing the relationship between black and white in this country. But he noted that religion had not always improved the lot of the oppressed and suffering. He reminded the delegates that religion had also undergirded slavery, and that the church had been guilty of gross negligence of minorities and the poor. And then he got specific. "When I move to your community and buy a home, and I'm being given a rough time," he asked, "will you take a stand? If my daughter falls in love with your son and they decide to get married, will you allow them to marry in peace? Will you reciprocate by accepting me as a brother?" This is what black Christian brethren are crying out for, a genuine relationship. Skinner challenged his white brethren to open the doors to their institutions, to provide black faculty and recruit black students for their colleges, to grant black writers and ministers access to their magazines and radio stations, and to let them talk about race, not just about communism and sex and movies and nightclubs. To do less than this, to mouth platitudes about equality and then to censure blacks who participated in protests and riots, or to relocate their congregations when blacks moved into the neighborhood, was to cry, "Give us Barabbas," and to crucify Christ anew. In another uncomfortable historical allusion, Ralph Abernathy, the black Baptist minister who succeeded Martin Luther King as the head of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, compared the law and order campaigns mounted by many politicians in 1968 to the campaign that elevated Hitler to Chancellor of Germany in 1933. Finally, a group of nearly 50 black ministers presented the Congress with a list of complaints, calling on white Christians to confess in word and action to the sins committed against black people, urging representatives of church agencies to foster equal employment practices, and asking church leaders to help blacks obtain improved urban housing. The Minneapolis Congress neither took nor recommended any specific direct action on racial issues, but evangelicals concerned for social action regarded as an important moment, and Graham himself took seriously the need to move beyond rhetoric and personal example. Though skeptical about the efficacy of forced busing, he made a series of 5 spot announcements urging Southern parents to obey the law on school integration. Then during a crusade in Anaheim, California, a few days later, he met E.V. Hill, a successful and influential Baptist pastor and close friend of Martin Luther King's. A conversation scheduled for 40 minutes stretched into 6 hours as Hill detailed with considerable emotion the impatience many black churchmen felt toward their white brethren. Shortly afterward, Graham arranged a meeting between a group of key black ministers and the President of the United States. He acknowledged that they would never have gotten to him in 100 years if I had not opened the door. But Nixon treated it as more than a courtesy visit. Though internal memos reveal that the President thought the meeting had run on much too long, over 3.5 hours, Graham recalled that they let him have it with both barrels, and he sat there and took it. And at least on the short run, and not without an eye for political advantage, Nixon responded to their complaints. The clergymen were quite specific, discussing such matters as their difficulty in getting funds from the Office of Economic Opportunity and the Department of Housing and Urban Development, for housing projects for senior citizens, and bonding restrictions that seemed to favor contractors. These appeals touched Nixon's compassionate as well as his calculating side. A Haldeman memo prior to the meeting indicated that the president is extremely interested in following up with Billy Graham in the work he is doing with Negro ministers across the country. He feels, as does Graham, that this may be our best chance to make inroads into the Negro community. But more than unvarnished political tactic was at work. Immediately after the April 1970 meeting, Haldeman informed Ehrlichman that Nixon wanted one of the projects cleared and done tomorrow. He points out that you can always find a way to do the things for the people on the other side, and that just for once, he'd like to see us find a way to do something right for the people on our side. He wants to see at least one of their projects approved and underway, if it means the staff at OEO have to take up a collection from their own pockets to raise the money to do it. Another staff memo indicated that we are exploring additional ways in which we can involve these men and assist in their efforts to solve the problems of their communities. Whatever the controlling motive, helpful action did occur, and at least some black ministers moved closer to the Republican camp. In May 1970, E.V. Hill wrote to Nixon to say that upon your instructions, your staff intervened and within a few days caused the program to commence and also enabled the program to have as its contractors two very able Negroes. I have not been quiet in proclaiming what you have personally done in this matter. I shall continue to tell my community of the interest of the president in a local matter. When Graham looked at Vietnam, his stance continued to be less clear than his views on civil rights. Just weeks after Nixon took office, the evangelist told reporters that we must have peace in Vietnam. I'm not only going to say I'm for peace, but I'm going to try to do something. In my particular area, it must be done in rather a quiet way. What he did immediately was to gather a group of missionary leaders from various parts of Southeast Asia for a three-day meeting in Bangkok, where they shared their perceptions on the war and offered specific recommendations for ending it. The men were not Tyros who had spent a few months in the area and were now calling for a worldwide day of prayer. Most had been in Vietnam from 5 to 20 years, and some enjoyed regular access to President Thieu and other members of the South Vietnamese government. Prior to the meeting, they interviewed hundreds of Vietnamese officials and other key people. In a 13-page confidential report to Nixon, Graham characterized them as a hawkish group, making their criticisms of the war all the more telling. According to the missionaries, the South Vietnamese people were overwhelmingly pro-American and pro-Nixon. But the Paris peace talks had generated a fear that a coalition government will be imposed on them that in the long run may lead to a communist takeover. The group also manifested a growing sense of disillusionment with Americans in Vietnam, citing reports that more than 40% of American troops are now on some form of dope or narcotics. They also charged that South Vietnamese officials and other citizens were enmeshed in a massive web of corruption largely traceable to the actions of Americans, particularly contractors and other businessmen, whom one missionary described as the crud of American society. As a result, at least a third of all the goods shipped to Vietnam from America eventually found their way onto the black market, and multiplied millions were being spent on programs that were colossal failures, creating disillusionment at the glaring corruption, incompetence, and waste of American civilians working for companies doing business in Vietnam. The missionaries believed that American policy was hopelessly misguided. Americanizing the war by providing extensive manpower and taking over the decision-making not only robbed the South Vietnamese of their dignity, but enabled the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese to appear like a little boy being beaten by an American giant, which gave them a tremendous propaganda weapon, even though their own giant, the communist world, stood directly behind them. To make matters worse, The American giant often appeared clumsy and ineffective, using methods of warfare learned at West Point and more appropriate in the battle theaters of World War II than in the jungles of Vietnam. Equally damaging, the missionaries felt, was the overwhelming cultural intrusion, particularly the flood of American consumer goods readily available through post exchanges and on the black market. If this kept up, they warned, we will have destroyed what we came to save, and that is the Vietnamese, their culture, and their freedom. The missionaries felt it was still possible to win the war if the Paris peace talks produced no honorable settlement. The first step would be to return the war to the Vietnamese, letting them fight it in the Oriental way. Guerrilla warfare, encouraged by Eisenhower and Kennedy, but de-emphasized by Johnson, should be resumed, using Oriental methods, which seem brutal and cruel in sophisticated Western eyes, but which are being used every day by the Viet Cong to spread terror and fear to the people. The North Vietnamese, they believed, feared a well-equipped and well-trained South Vietnamese army using guerrilla tactics, far more than they feared American soldiers. Especially valuable in a renewed emphasis on guerrilla warfare would be the mountain people, whom the missionaries felt they could control for another year or two, despite intense efforts by the Chinese to win their allegiance. America should also encourage and equip North Vietnamese defectors to return to the North to engage in guerrilla warfare, and ultimately to attempt a coup. Why, Graham asked, should all the fighting be in the South? By missionary estimates, perhaps no more than 10,000 of the 27 million North Vietnamese were hardcore communists. The rest, they suspected, would welcome liberation by anti-communist forces, because ineffective and insensitive American policy provided the Viet Cong with important psychological advantages. Graham and his colleagues recommended major attention to propaganda. Instead of showing 10 hours of American movies a day, he said, use our vast television investment for propaganda purposes, with concentrated attention to boosting Vietnamese morale, helping them feel a kinship with free nations throughout the world, and exposing communist tyranny by such methods as interviewing Viet Cong defectors and showing the terrorism by the communists right on television. This last tactic alone, he felt, would do more than anything we can think of. Used properly, Graham believed, the multi-million-dollar radio and television system, devoted almost entirely to entertainment purposes, would produce 5,000 or more defectors from the Viet Cong every month. Finally, he recommended that the Southeast Asian Treaty Organization be reorganized. It is totally out of date, and that Nixon convene an Asian summit conference. When Graham's report, which varied somewhat from his repeated public insistence that he limited his counsel with political leaders to spiritual matters, became available for public inspection in February 1989, he noted characteristically that the views contained in it were largely those of the missionaries, and that he had merely conveyed those views to the president. It is clear, however, that he agreed with them, not only from his own statements in the report, but also from the fact that 6 months after he had sent it to Nixon, he sent a copy to Henry Kissinger, assistant to the President for National Security Affairs, noting that Defense Secretary Melvin Laird had been impressed with it, and expressing his hope that Kissinger would also pay heed to it. Kissinger, too, had found it quite useful, and was looking into the points which they raised. Less concretely, Graham also began to voice an ambivalence about the war, reflecting the missionaries' influence. In an interview with Dotson Rader, grandson of evangelist Paul Rader, under whose preaching Nixon made his boyhood commitment to Christ, Graham revealed that he understood the feelings of the people of Southeast Asia, who are frightened that we might pull out, but added that America can't be the world's policeman. We have far too many problems at home, growing too dangerous. And also, I'm not at all sure that the war is supportable, morally supportable. I'm simply not sure at all. Despite his misgivings, Graham could not bring himself to disagree openly with government policy, and he was at pains to show himself in sympathy with the views of Richard Nixon. When the Christian Herald, one of his early boosters, published an editorial opposing U.S. policy in Vietnam on both moral and legal grounds, Nixon asked Graham to find out who, specifically, had been responsible. Graham reported that the culprit was David Polling, who openly professes his liberal thinking on practically all matters and had led the magazine increasingly to the left during his tenure as president of the Christian Herald Association. Graham suggested, however, that Nixon need not be too concerned about the editorial. The circulation and influence of the magazine had been declining steadily in recent years, and he believed it definitely could not have any kind of impact on American Protestant thinking at the present time. Besides, he added, Christianity Today is well known as the most influential Protestant news journal, and it consistently takes stands opposite to those of the Christian Herald. In addition to his efforts to help find some solution to the war in Vietnam, Graham stood ready to serve as president at any other promising juncture where he might be needed. Before a meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir, he told Nixon, "If you have any suggestions as to how I may contribute in this delicate Middle East situation, please let me know." The White House evidently did not feel the evangelist was overreaching. One staffer suggested to Kissinger that Graham should convey to Mrs. Meir a sense of American unease over Israeli military strategy, specifically a series of aggressive airstrikes against its neighbors during the summer of 1969. Nixon also relayed Graham's offer to Kissinger and asked for a report on the meeting between Graham and Meir. There seems to be no record of the meeting itself, but Graham was clearly perceived during this period as one of Israel's valued friends. The Worldwide Pictures film, His Land, released in 1969, outlined Graham's theological understanding of the role of Israel in God's grand historical plan and was well received by Jewish leaders both in Israel and America. The film moved prominent Rabbi Mark Tannenbaum to declare that for acts of friendship toward the Jewish people at a time of turmoil, which has not been altogether congenial to Jewish security, Billy Graham deserves better than a stereotyped skeptical response from thoughtful Jews and many others, while not ignoring basic differences. Graham offered to provide similar diplomatic services, as well as to gain entree to yet another world leader, when he asked Dwight Chapin to see about having the American ambassador to France arrange a meeting with that nation's new president, Georges Pompidou. A few months later, when Graham's schedule placed him in Paris at the time of Charles de Gaulle's death, he wired the White House to let Nixon know that he would be available for anything he might want me to do in connection with de Gaulle's death. In each of these cases, Graham probably had more to gain than the president, but on two other occasions in 1970, he exposed himself to sharp criticism and enthusiastically lent himself and his prestige to efforts that Nixon's staff hoped would shore up the president's policies and popularity and rally support for the administration. In May 1970, Graham held a crusade in the stadium at the University of Tennessee at Knoxville and invited the president not only to attend but to address the crowd. Another crusade first. Lyndon Johnson had attended a crusade while president but had not spoken. Graham, of course, insisted his invitation was free from political intent and professed bafflement that anyone should think otherwise. "If Mr. Nixon had been running for election," he acknowledged, "I could understand the charge of politics, but he is the president. I wouldn't think that you'd call the president political." Years later, he still maintained that his only concern had been spiritual. "I was going to preach the straight gospel. I thought he needed to hear it. I had him sit on the platform, of course. He was president of the United States." Not everyone agreed with Graham's assessment. In a CBS News editorial, Dan Rather asserted that whatever the evangelist's intent, Nixon had leapt at the chance to make a safe, popular appearance in the South. By identifying with Graham, who was enormously popular in his native region, the president hoped to give a boost to Republican candidates in that year's elections. He was particularly interested in the race for governor of Alabama, where a defeat to George Wallace would derail his troublesome presidential ambitions, and in the Republican attempt to unseat Democratic Senator Albert Gore Sr. in Tennessee. He did not think it seemly to campaign directly against the two men, but his advisors were said to feel that standing with Billy Graham would provide just the right touch. Secondarily, at a time when colleges were erupting in protest against the Vietnam War, the killings at Kent State had occurred just 10 days earlier. Nixon sought to prove he could appear on a major campus without creating an uproar. And it seemed unlikely that a stadium full of Billy Graham supporters gathered from conservative East Tennessee would explode into anti-establishment chaos, especially since a state law made it a crime to disrupt a religious service. The evening proved to be less than the total triumph Nixon and his advisors hoped for. As he and Graham strode across the stadium turf on their way to the platform, a sweeping ovation washed over them, and a contingent of volunteers from the Fellowship of Christian Athletes and the unsmiling and vigilant corps of Secret Service agents provided an impenetrable defense against a small band of protesters holding placards recalling the biblical injunctions against killing or kneeling at the edge of the field in memory of those who had died in Vietnam. After Graham introduced Nixon, noting that, "I'm for change, but the Bible teaches us to obey authority," the president urged the youth night crowd to depend upon those great spiritual sources that have made America the great country that it is. When several hundred hecklers, scattered about the stadium, responded to that bit of piety with chants of "Bullshit! Bullshit! And stop the crap and end the war," the huge crowd swamped them with new waves of applause and cheers of approval that continued for several minutes. At one point, Nixon asked for attention, but he knew that most of the crowd was with him. He acknowledged the existence of different points of view and asserted his own belief in dissent, but added with a triumphant smile, "I'm just glad that there seems to be a rather solid majority on one side rather than on the other side tonight." A verdict that touched off still another torrential ovation. Overall, it was a satisfying evening for the president. Time called it one of the most effective speeches he has yet delivered. And when the service was telecast a few weeks later, most of the protest had been edited out, making it appear even better. Later that evening, after Air Force One arrived in California, Henry Kissinger called from San Clemente to tell Graham how much Nixon had appreciated the opportunity to have a part in the service. Graham's other key effort to quiet the turmoil bedeviling the president occurred when he and Bob Hope teamed with Disney personnel, Reader's Digest publisher Hobart Lewis, and hotel magnate J. Willard Marriott Sr., to produce a July 4 religio-patriotic extravaganza known as Honor America Day. The exact genesis of the super salute to God and country is difficult to pin down, but Graham was obviously involved at the earliest stages, and despite insistence that it was strictly a non-governmental affair, the White House played a central role in its planning and execution. The official rationale for the event was that in those troubled times, a divided nation needed an opportunity to renew and express its commitment to its deepest and most precious ideals and values, and to celebrate the glorious joys of being an American. A combination revival meeting and national birthday party. In keeping with that aim, the organizers attempted to sound all the major chords in America's heart song, with little sense that excess might detract from effectiveness. When told that a team of marathoners would relay an American flag from Philadelphia to Washington, and that the flag's arrival at the Lincoln Memorial would touch off a worship service presided over by Billy Graham, H.R. Haldeman did not wince in fear that many Americans might find the blending of civil and sacred symbols too blatant. Instead, he wrote on the memo, "Great idea. Start from Liberty Bell. Maybe others from Williamsburg, Jamestown, Mount Vernon, etc." Later, he suggested that most of all, we need a solid cornball program developer. Billy Graham's participation went far beyond letting his name appear at the top of the stationery and showing up to preach. BGEA seconded Walter Smith to work on the project full-time, and Cliff Barrows oversaw the planning of the music for the religious service. Graham mentioned Honor America Day on his Hour of Decision broadcast, sent a special letter urging his East Coast supporters to attend the celebration and dispatched several staffers to stir up interest among churches within reasonable driving distance of Washington. He personally encouraged black ministers to support the event, since an all-white gathering would appear too flagrantly Republican. He also tried to make sure that others did their part. In a memo to Charles Colson, Dwight Chapin noted that Graham is pushing everyone very hard, and when we run up against problems, Billy immediately reacts to the call and gets people tracking right. A call of thanks to keep him charged up would be a good touch. The festivities themselves went smoothly. Rabbi Tannenbaum, Bishop Sheen, and E.V. Hill led prayers. And astronaut Frank Borman, the first man to pray publicly in outer space, was on hand to remind the assembly of the glories of prayers past. The U.S. Army Band and the Southern Baptist Male Chorus lent collective gravity to the occasion. Pat Boone, Kate Smith, and Johnny Cash sang patriotic favorites. And country singer Jeannie C. Riley warned that, "When you're running down my country, hoss, you're walking on the fighting side of me." On the ideological edges of the crowd, leftist and other anti-war groups protested the American presence in Southeast Asia, and right-wingers damned the administration for not really trying to win in Vietnam. In the center, where he felt most comfortable, Billy Graham ticked off the reasons why America was worthy of honor. A generous America, he said, had repeatedly opened its doors to the distressed. Instead of hiding and denying its problems, it recognized and tried to solve them, giving all the right to voice their opinions freely, even when they ran counter to the policies of the government and will of the majority. And most important of all, America should be honored because of its pervasive faith in God Almighty. It was vintage 4th of July affair, and vintage Graham, a shining example of his ability to articulate the beliefs and sentiments of the great and decent center segment of American culture. The crowds on hand were disappointingly small. CBS estimated the total turnout as approximately 15,000. But millions watching network news heard Graham proclaim that we honor America because she defends the right of her citizens to dissent. Call dissent the hallmark of our freedom in America, and thunder in conclusion, honor the nation. And as you move to do it, never give in, never give in, never, 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 never. Despite failure to attract the hoped-for vast crowd, the White House was pleased. Patrick Buchanan urged Chapin to distribute pictures of Graham preaching in front of the Lincoln Memorial to all publications, to mail a copy of his sermon to every minister in America, and to see to it that the sermon was reprinted in the Reader's Digest. No one appeared more appreciative than Nixon, who both called and wrote Graham to commend him on his speech, assuring him that he had touched the hearts of millions, and noting that the Honor America Day ceremonies reinforced my own conviction that it is time to strike back, not in anger and not in a mean spirit, but in affirmation of those enduring values that have proved themselves in crisis and trouble, generation after generation, and given our nation its greatness. Graham never imagined for a moment that Nixon's values varied from his own, or doubted that Richard Nixon was God's man for that critical hour in American history. In a handwritten note near the end of the president's second year in office, Graham wrote, "My expectations were high when you took office nearly 2 years ago, but you have exceeded them in every way. You have given moral and spiritual leadership to the nation at a time when we desperately needed it, in addition to courageous political leadership. Thank you." He signed the letter with affection. Chapter 23, The Power and the Glory. Despite his enthusiasm for the task, Graham's dabbling in the political arena occupied only a small portion of his time. His primary commitment and energy still went into preaching the gospel as effectively and widely as possible, and encouraging movements and institutions that would enhance the growth and respectability of middle-of-the-road evangelicalism. A lung problem that caused him to cut back on his crusade schedule in 1968 left him time not only to offer counsel to candidate Nixon, but also to pursue his continuing interest in a school that would serve the East Coast as Fuller and Wheaton served the West and Midwest. Graham apparently entertained few regrets about declining John MacArthur's offer to underwrite a full-scale university, but when the opportunity came to create an Eastern counterpart to Fuller Seminary, a smaller and more manageable project that would not require him to neglect evangelism, he could not resist. That possibility arose as a result of an unusual set of circumstances involving the usual cast of characters. When Temple University in Philadelphia began to accept government funds in the mid-60s, it was forced by law to divest itself of its seminary, the Conwell School of Theology, named for Temple's founder, 19th-century evangelical philanthropist Russell Conwell. The seminary was small, with only 5 faculty members, a couple of buildings, and fewer than 50 students. The easiest course would have been simply to close down, but institutions resist death. Daniel Pauling, a prominent clergyman and friend of Graham who was a member of Temple's board, had another plan. At a quickly arranged meeting in Penn Station, while Graham awaited a train to Montreat, Pauling put the kind of pressure on Billy that Billy often put on others. "We've got to do something," he told Graham, "and I've got it on my heart that you should have it," adding that J. Howard Pugh had it on his heart as well. Smarting from the United Presbyterian Church's recent refusal of his offer to build an evangelical seminary that would stand for the integrity of Scripture, Pugh pledged to throw generous support behind Conwell if Billy Graham would take charge. Graham resisted, but Pauling pressed, and apparently thinking he saw a glimmer of interest, kept on pressing. Finally, echoing William Bell Riley's words 20 years earlier, he told Graham, "I'll just have to meet you at the judgment of God with this, because I know you're the one to take it." The threat that he might be out of God's will if he spurned Pauling's offer pushed Billy's bulky camel on through the eye of the needle. "To make a long story short," he recalled, "I took it, but with this understanding, all the board and all the faculty would resign, and I would name a new board and a new faculty." Of course, that created some problems. Perhaps only Billy Graham would have dared set such conditions, but Pauling accepted, and the Temple board agreed in essence to give Conwell to Graham, to let him do with it whatever he wanted. What he wanted was a board and faculty whose judgment and theology he trusted, and that is what he got. He packed the 18-member board with old friends and associates: Leighton Ford, Stephen Olford, Alan Emery, Carlos Morris, Robert Van Campen, Roger Hull, and other dependables, mostly from the Northeast. Only 4 of the resigning trustees were asked to stay on. An all-new evangelical faculty was formed, led by Stuart Babbage, a professor of theology at the Columbia Presbyterian Seminary in Atlanta. In an innovative attempt to recruit and train black clergymen, Graham arranged to have regular seminary classes taught in a black section of the city to make it easier on students who might find it difficult to come to the Temple campus for all their classes. After about a year, Graham began working on Harold Akinge to take over the day-to-day leadership of the school. Akinge was favorably inclined, but was also considering an offer to become president of Gordon College and Divinity School, an evangelical school in Wenham, Massachusetts, north of Boston. "One day we're talking on the phone," Graham recalled, "and I honestly don't remember which one of us said it, but one of us said, 'Why should we try to build 2 schools on the East Coast? We have one great school, Fuller, on the West Coast. Why not have one great school on the East Coast?'" The prospect of merger, with the attendant advantage of avoiding competition for faculty, students, and money, appealed to both men. Because the Temple campus was crowded, and because Graham felt a location in the Boston area would provide the most desirable intellectual cachet, it made sense for Conwell to move to New England. Since Graham had that school's board in his pocket, his suggestion of a merger met little resistance. The Gordon board took more persuading, but Akinge handled those negotiations, a task doubtless made easier by the prospect that access to Howard Pugh's millions might finally end the little school's chronic financial problems. Pugh was entirely willing to make good on his offer to back Graham's project, but not without qualification. Because he was convinced that association with an undergraduate college would divert attention from the seminary's primary task, and ultimately, that a liberal arts curriculum would undermine the authority of Scripture, he insisted that the new seminary divorce itself from Gordon College. Faced with the need to find a new home for a school that did not yet even exist, Graham approached another of his New England friends, Richard Cardinal Cushing. Billy pointed out to the Cardinal that a Carmelite seminary in South Hamilton, near Wenham, had only 24 or so students. "We want to put a major institution out there," he told Cushing. "We need that seminary." The prelate got on the telephone immediately. He didn't always use evangelical Protestant language when he talked to his assistants, Graham remembered, and found out that the seminary was indeed quite underutilized. Not long afterward, J. Howard Pugh put up $2 million to buy the land and several million more to refurbish existing facilities and to build and stock a library. With a new and attractive setting, a Graham-appointed board and faculty, and the combined 310-member student body from the two constituent schools, the Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary got off to a brisk start in 1970. Enrollment quickly boomed, and two decades later, more than 550 students were preparing for the ministry in one of the largest and most vigorous seminaries in the country. And Billy Graham was still chairman of the board. In the midst of establishing a new educational institution, Graham rebounded sufficiently from his health problems to return to Australia and New Zealand early in 1969 to finish a series of meetings cut short the year before. In 1970, he used an ambitious and innovative television relay system to transmit a crusade in Dortmund, Germany, to theaters, arenas, and stadiums throughout Western Europe and into Yugoslavia, unscrambling babble, as one aide put it, to reach speakers of 8 different languages. Then, after more than 3 years of attending mainly to foreign fields, he returned to America for 2 full years of domestic crusades in Anaheim, New York City, Knoxville, Baton Rouge, Lexington, Chicago, Oakland, Dallas-Fort Worth, Charlotte, Birmingham, and Cleveland. For the most part, these were standard crusades with standard results, including the standard announcements of record-breaking closing-day crowds and higher-than-average rates of response to the invitation. They were not, however, performed in a vacuum, and Graham found that wherever he went, he was obliged to adapt not only to current events and improved technology, but also to his status as a symbol friends and foes alike could use in service of their own agendas. The 2-part visit to Australia and New Zealand was a mixture of joyous reunion and rude rebuff. Perhaps no event in that region's history had affected religious life more than Graham's triumphant tour in 1959. Now, a decade later, crusade committees and counseling classes and the pulpits of cooperating churches contained hundreds of people who proudly identified themselves as 59ers, men and women who had first come to faith in Graham's original crusade and were happily going on in the Lord. The response in Sydney, where evangelicals uncharacteristically had the strongest voice in Anglican circles, was generally warm and enthusiastic. Crowds were good. Over 500,000 in 8 days, and first-timers made up an unusually high 70% of the inquirers, a statistic that delighted both team and sponsors. Since first-timers are more likely to represent a net addition to church roles than our rededicators, Graham's postponing of scheduled crusades in Melbourne and New Zealand may have made it harder to regenerate excitement when he returned in 1969. Whatever the explanation, neither proved as receptive as they had been in 1959. The evangelist managed to sidestep discussion of Vietnam during his 1968 visit to Sydney, but his perceived closeness to Nixon and the increased unpopularity of American policy made him the target of sharper questioning from newspaper and TV reporters during the 1969 tour. Unidentified antagonists threatened to bomb his meeting in Auckland, and a group of anti-war protesters interrupted a service at the Meyer Music Bowl in Melbourne. When Leighton Ford, normally well-received by college groups, spoke at the University of Adelaide, He was heckled by students who launched dozens of paper airplanes at him as he spoke. Perturbed that the ever-polite Graham and his associates could be treated so rudely, Christianity Today speculated that the day might soon return when Christians would be stoned for their faith. Despite these problems, the 1969 tour was far from a failure. An estimated 85,000 came to the cricket grounds for the closing service in Melbourne, and an unusually large number of youthful inquirers gave promise of long-term benefit to the churches. Graham's continuing ability to draw large numbers of young people to his crusade encouraged and intrigued him, and moved him to make an honest, if limited, attempt to understand the 60s youth culture. He purchased a stack of rock albums, and after he and Ruth listened to them at least once, declared that he had been frankly surprised to find that a lot of rock music is deeply religious, in the sense that the lyrics asked, "What is the purpose of my life? Where did I come from? And where am I going?" He tried to mingle inconspicuously with hippies and protesters at several festivals and demonstrations, at least once donning fake whiskers to disguise his appearance. While he continued to deplore discourtesy and disorder and still regarded student radicals as a menace to society, he came away with a mostly positive view of what he had seen and heard. With their talk of Jesus boots and almost biblical language, he said, probably not intending to assign all the language of the counterculture to this near-canonical category, they show an unconscious longing for Christ. To be sure, he disapproved of some tactics favored by young protesters. Still, he felt that they are asking the right questions and insisted that they have a right to want to change the system. In an effort to reach young people, Graham changed his own system somewhat. At his 1969 New York crusade, the team rented a ballroom near Madison Square Garden and operated what they billed as America's largest coffee house, complete with strobe lights and screens that flashed Jesus in love, while the Opry crusade set gathered to talk with each other and a covey of youth counselors in an atmosphere of psychedelic lighting and amplified folk rock music, played by young Christian musicians, some of whom testified to their recent rescue from drugs and digging the sex scene. Later that year, Graham accepted an invitation to speak at a rock festival in Miami. His audience on that occasion seemed more interested in leaflets urging the legalization of marijuana than in his hearty approbation of the terrific music he'd heard and his promises of a way to get high without hang-ups and hangovers. But he told reporters he had received a tremendous response and declared that he planned to attend more such gatherings because this is where the young people are that I want to reach. I love these kids. I really do. Not all young people return such expressions of goodwill. During a Chicago crusade, a group of approximately 300 protesters, identified by the Chicago Daily News as hippies, but branded as Satanists by Graham and Christianity Today, tried to disrupt the youth service at McCormick Place. Notified in advance of their plans, Graham prayed for forgiveness of and kindness toward the disruptors, but made it plain they would not be allowed to take over the service. "There's a small group of people here, highly organized and ready to demonstrate," he informed the crowd of 27,000. "You came to hear the gospel, and we paid for this hall. I'm sure you will know what to do when the time comes. And there are enough of you here to do it." When a contingent of troublemakers came forward during the second hymn of the service, Graham interrupted the choir and asked the thousands of young Christians in the arena to surround them and to love them, pray for them, sing to them, and gradually ease them back toward the entrances through which they've come. A small band of about 30 Jesus people joined hands to form a circle around the primary disruptors, chanting, "Jesus is the way, join the Jesus revolution," and simply, "Jesus, Jesus, Jesus, Jesus." Some singled out individual Satanists and began to share their faith with them, or in more dramatic fashion, threw their arms around them and began to pray for their salvation. Thousands remained in their seats, imploring God's Spirit to confound the work of Satan in our midst, while hundreds of other young people formed an irresistible human wave that swept the interlopers toward the exits. A scuffle broke out briefly when one of the protesters tossed a firecracker, but swift police intervention forestalled any serious conflict, and the service resumed with an exhilarating sense of triumph over the enemy. A similar incident in Oakland the following month was handled in the same manner. Billy's concern for understanding young people no doubt stemmed in part from watching his own brood move into adulthood. Second daughter Anne, described by siblings and non-family members alike as a near model child, had limited her flirtation with the world to bleaching her hair and paying considerable attention to makeup. But the results had been appealing enough to win her part-time work as a model for several of Asheville's better clothing stores. Some dour fundamentalists may have clucked at such behavior, but the Grahams saw no harm in it. Anne recalled quite simply that Mother totally trusted me and encouraged me and loved me. Therefore, I was always the person she thought I was. Like Sister Gigi, Anne was married at 18. In her case, to former University of North Carolina basketball star Danny Lotz, who subsequently became a dentist and an active worker in the Fellowship of Christian Athletes. Bunny, who attended the Stony Brook School for Girls on Long Island, followed her older sister's example, also marrying at 18. The groom was Fred and Millie Dienert's son, Ted, whom she met for the first time at the 1966 London Crusade. Ted subsequently entered his father's advertising business and eventually became producer of Graham's syndicated television programs. Ruth and Billy were mildly disappointed that none of their daughters got more than a smattering of college, but were pleased with the men they chose for husbands, all of them older and competent, all of them active Christians. Franklin gave them more cause for concern. More than any of the siblings, Franklin chafed at the role of son and namesake of the world's most famous preacher, and he determined not to wear his father's mantle gracefully. At age 10, he supposedly asked Christ to come into his heart. But if the invitation was accepted, Christ found but a small and disorderly back room in which to dwell. As a teenager, Franklin flaunted the very behaviors evangelicals shunned. He smoked and drank, wore long hair, drove fast cars, rode a Harley-Davidson motorcycle, and stayed out past midnight with girls who did not seem well suited for life in a parsonage. He fired a shotgun through his bedroom window and set his stereo in front of the intercom system just to irritate his family. And he warded poor Ned unconscionably. After a brief stay at Stony Brook School for Boys, where his parents hoped he might straighten up, he came home to finish at the local public high school. But he was never a good student, as one old friend delicately observed. Franklin's schooling was a matter of prayer for some time within the family. Friends despaired over Franklin, fearing he might fit the mold of the preacher's child gone bad. There was a period in there, one observed, when I thought Ruth and Billy had a moral casualty on their hands. Ruth and Billy were apparently never quite as worried as their friends. I never pretended to be the stereotype of a fellow with a Bible under my arm, Franklin recalled, but my parents pretty much let me be. They knew the Lord would deal with me on these things. Not that his behavior was ignored or winked at. After telling him she preferred he smoke and drink at home rather than sneak away to indulge his vices, Ruth grew so disgusted with his smoking that she once emptied his ashtray on his head while he slept. Their relationship, however, was less truly adversarial than like a sparring match, with each protagonist respecting the other's point of view and neither regarding the other as an enemy. Always jealous of his privacy, Franklin habitually locked his bedroom door to keep his mother out. One morning, after he had come in later than she deemed appropriate, Ruth crawled out on the roof, a tin cup full of water in her mouth, intending to creep over to his open window and splash him into wakefulness. Franklin heard her coming and slammed the window down just in time to stop the deluge. A sporting loser, Ruth sat on the shingles and joined her son in a good laugh. Ruth was able to show a special forbearance toward Franklin, it seems, because she understood his rambunctious spirit. She, too, sometimes became aggressive with machines, so much so that novice drivers in Montreat were warned to watch out for Mrs. Graham, who seemed to regard speed limits and lane dividers as optional suggestions rather than legal boundaries. As she sped along, quite aware she was breaking the law, she frequently offered a brief exculpatory prayer. "Father, I'm sorry, but you understand." Whatever God thought, A state trooper who caught her doing 80 on old U.S. 70 between Waynesville and Montreat thought she needed reproof and correction. Anxious to get home to serve tea to Billy and the favored guest, Ruth accepted the ticket without arguing or trading on her name, but she stopped short of repentance. "Could you please hurry with that?" she asked. "And when you finish, please don't follow me, because I'm going to have to do it again." For a time, it appeared Ruth might add motorcycles to her arsenal of offensive weapons. Instead of scolding Franklin for roaring through the sleepy campus of Montreat Anderson College on his Harley Hog, she asked him to teach her how to ride it. She was not a natural, but neither was she a quitter. The first time she climbed aboard by herself, she drove it over an embankment on the highway. When a worried truck driver got out to offer help, she assured him she was fine. "If you could just get it on the pavement, head it in the other direction," she said. "I have a friend at the end of the road who helped me stop." That experience didn't stop her. Her second try ended when she plunged into a lake. Not until her third effort, when she mistook the accelerator for the brake, ending in yet another scary heap and severing a vein in her leg, did this middle-aged preacher's wife abandon this particular form of fun on the open road. Graham's 1969 New York Crusade drew capacity crowds to the garden, but it differed from previous American crusades in that the primary focus was on the television audience. The successful use of television relays in the 1966 and 1967 British crusades convinced the evangelists to experiment further with that medium. This time, in addition to relaying the service to various auditoriums in outlying areas, he arranged to have local television stations broadcast all 10 of the garden services, 3 times each in the New York area, and once each in a dozen other cities. Response was good, and the team regarded the experiment as a success. But the saturation live coverage in specific cities proved no more effective than the customary 3-night nationwide broadcast several weeks after the crusade, and this particular strategy was not repeated. Graham and his team, however, remained convinced that nothing could multiply the impact of a crusade so effectively and economically as television, and that although an arena or stadium crusade might draw more people overall, the proportion of inquirers tended to be a bit higher in the relay halls. In 1970, they launched an elaborate and ambitious effort to reach Western Europe and Yugoslavia with simultaneous transmission and translation of crusade services from Dortmund, Germany. To offset initial skepticism, BGEA paid to bring a sizable number of clergymen from all over Europe to Frankfurt for a demonstration of the IDA 4 big-screen projection system to show them how effective it could be. Most were sufficiently convinced to return home and attempt to enlist other clergy in their regions to support the project, soon to be known as Euro 70. Cooperation did not follow automatically. In some cases, it never came at all. Evangelical churches in France, where Graham's old friend Bob Evans was still active, signed on immediately and enthusiastically, as did Denmark and Norway. Sweden and Finland chose to remain uninvolved. Holland and Belgium agreed, but not until the last minute. In Belgium's case, because of resistance from Roman Catholic influence within the state-run television authority. Small evangelical populations and non-cooperation from Catholics left Spain and Italy out of the network. In Yugoslavia, however, the only Eastern European country to participate, the Roman Catholic Church, still warm with the memory of Graham's 1967 visit, not only publicized the crusade, but offered St. Marko Krsvičanin's church in Zagreb as the meeting site. Great Britain was represented among the venues, but London and other major cities chose not to participate. According to a journalist covering the event for both Christianity Today, CT, and worldwide publications, British evangelicals were not keen on broadcasting a crusade originating in Germany, with a German translator standing alongside Graham. Ironically, perhaps the strongest opposition among participating countries came from within Germany itself, where according to CT, the theological centers of influence and the churches lay under the devastating spell of humanism and theological liberalism. In addition to the same theological objections they had raised against Graham's meeting since his days with Youth for Christ, they now objected to spending great sums of money on a television extravaganza when the money could be used to feed the hungry. Probably more significant, a number of socially liberal German clergymen objected vehemently to Graham's political views and activities. At a meeting in Dortmund of nearly 500 ministers whose divided opinions led to outbreaks of boos, hisses, and table banging, Graham was asked why he had not participated in the demonstrations in America against racism and the war. On the question of race, he replied, "I'm already holding demonstrations in the biggest stadiums and halls in the world. But because they are nonviolent, people think that's not a demonstration. It is a demonstration." When pressed to make some clear statement on Vietnam, his artful use of Martin Luther's image of two kingdoms elided much of his effort on behalf of the Nixon administration and probably would have caused his friend in the White House to wince, but it turned away the wrath of most of the challenging clergymen. "You greatly misunderstand my ministry," he said. "I do not represent the U.S. government. I represent the kingdom of God. My flag is the flag of Christ." Why did Jesus Christ not lead a demonstration against the tyranny of Rome? Why did Paul not lead a demonstration? Because they represented a different kingdom. I cannot defend the United States any more than you can defend what went on in the 30s and 40s in Germany. Then, to turn away wrath on the issue of Vietnam, he said, "Now, concerning Vietnam, I promise you this. If Germany is invaded by a foreign power and the U.S. comes to your aid, I will not lead a demonstration down Pennsylvania Avenue against giving you that aid." According to one witness, that statement brought prolonged and unanimous applause. Still, out of fear that anti-war activists would use the crusade to mount some kind of dramatic protest, the speaker's platform was constructed at a height and in such a manner that allowed the television cameras to remain focused on Graham and ignore any disturbance that might be going on below. As a further hedge against disruption, a secure backup studio was installed underneath the platform, where Graham and his interpreter could carry on alone in the event of a truly serious outbreak. The logistics of Euro 70 were far more complicated than those for its British predecessors. Though the All-Britain Crusade had been fed to 25 cities whose inhabitants all spoke the same language, the technicians in each city followed a common set of technical specifications to affect the transmission. Euro 70 used the international television links of the Eurovision system. But engineers still had to cope with different sets of specs and the problems inherent in the simultaneous translation of one sermon into the language of each participating nation. When the crusade finally got underway in April 1970, nearly 1,000 men at 39 venues in 10 nations, Austria and Switzerland had joined those already named, were involved in the largest closed-circuit television network ever organized in Europe. In addition to the television transmission, the crusade was also carried by Trans World Radio, a powerful missionary station in Monte Carlo to Africa and the Middle East, as well as to all of Eastern and Western Europe. To adhere to the strict time demands of radio, technicians would begin to edit tapes a few minutes after the services began, start the landline transmission from Dortmund to Monte Carlo, then hope they could edit the remainder of the service and sermon to fit their allotted one-hour time slot. On several of the 8 evenings of the crusade, their transmission exceeded 58 minutes. On one evening, it ran a scant 2 seconds short of the 60-minute cutoff point. But no broadcast ran over. Not everything worked so well. One evening at the Westfalenhalle in Dortmund, a British lighting engineer's attempt to make a cup of coffee in an electric kettle blew out a fuse that temporarily killed the sound transmission to all 39 cities in the network. Response to the crusade reflected the religious situation in participating countries. In Norway, where evangelicals were cooperating on a nationwide scale for the first time in their history, interest and enthusiasm ran so high that church leaders predicted Graham could hold successful crusades in any city in the country. In neighboring Denmark, however, one of Copenhagen's finest auditoriums was no more than a quarter full on opening night and never reached capacity. Austria showed similar diversity, with near indifference in Vienna, better reception in Graz, and excellent crowds and response at Salzburg, where the services were piped into the Mozarteum. In strongly secular France, attendance was rather poor, but those who came responded warmly to Graham and his message. In Zagreb, large crowds overflowed from the cathedral into an auxiliary hall. Once again, Graham proved to be exceedingly popular with German audiences, leading the Reverend Johannes Heider, pastor of Dortmund's largest state Lutheran church, to observe that the simple proclamation of the Bible by Billy Graham has brought more results